and the happy music is playing, and that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour, where the conversations are all real, but the cocktails are strictly a metaphor. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm here at the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
Well, I am an editor at NPR Music.
And to Stephen's left, Trey Graham, what do you do?
I edit movie coverage at the website.
And swinging around to Trey's left, what do you do for NPR, Glenn Weldon?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm happy that you could all be here today. And we are here to continue, among other things, our Oscars coverage, which we kicked off last week when the nominations had just been announced. But
I think our Oscar coverage consisted of, here are the movies nominated for Best Picture.
Well, that's true. But we left last week, you will all remember, with a very specific challenge that had been laid down. Stephen, do you remember the details of that challenge?
You know, I do. They are fresh in my mind. We discussed, you know, you listed off the 10 movies that were nominated for Best Picture, and I sheepishly admitted that I had only seen two of them. I had seen Inception, and I had seen Black Swan, but that left eight movies that I had not seen, and I made a solemn vow, because I am nothing if not a man of integrity and character.
And solemn vows.
And solemn vows, that I would see the other eight by the time we recorded this podcast again.
And I believe we took bets around the table on how many that you would see.
I seem to recall our producer, Mike Katziff, holding up three sarcastic fingers.
I believe.
The only way they could have been more sarcastic is if they had been forming finger quotes.
Yes. Or if all three of them had been the same finger, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
Now, so Mike went with three. I believe Trey also went with three.
I went with three. It's true.
Glenn Weldon, how many did you go with?
I went for the big four.
Glenn went with the big four. And after going initially for four.
Yes. I believe one of my dear friends in this room decided that she believed in me.
That's right. I've cast my lot.
That's right.
With the idea that you would see all eight of these movies.
At least with the idea.
Possibility of grave disappointment be damned. I cast my lot with you. So let's kill the suspense. How many of these eight movies did you actually wind up seeing?
I believe, I don't know how I can do this without simultaneously raising the roof. I saw all eight movies.
Congratulations.
He is kind of raising the roof. Yes. You saw all eight, so you have.
I believe Mike Katziff is giving me the
Katziff is doing the slow clap.
The patented NPR Music slow clap that we do in meetings all the time.
So you saw all eight, so you have now seen all 10 of the Best Picture nominees.
I have seen 10 out of 10.
All right.
I would just like to acknowledge having.
Oh, how many have you seen, Trey?
Having expressed doubt about your ability to catch up with all of the Best Picture nominees in a single week, I would like to confess that I did not see a single extra Best Picture nominee, so I'm still at six.
I'd like to point out that I saw all eight of those movies over the weekend.
I would like to point out that that is quite an accomplishment, but I saw 9 hours of theater over the weekend, so I could not play.
I also went to a concert.
Oh. Crazy, and yet you met the challenge.
Also, I fell into a crevasse and
had to cut off
one of my own limbs. You can guess which one.
You may be a hero. So tell me, Stephen, which of the eight that you saw, which was your favorite?
Which was my favorite? I really liked 127 Hours.
So did
I. 127 Hours was, speaking of arms being sawn off, not the only movie involving some sort of amputation.
That is true.
And not only Toy Story 3, in which Mr. Potato Head's arm falls off in the first 20 seconds.
That's true.
Obviously, it's an intense movie. It's a gripping movie. There are scenes in which you watch through webbed fingers. But I loved the way Danny Boyle, the director, worked around sort of the challenges of having one actor, James Franco, sort of pinned in one place for a vast majority of the movie and still making it exciting and inspiring, but not too inspiring. And, I mean, obviously, you know how that movie's going to end. I thought the music in it was exceptionally well chosen. And I would probably say that's my favorite of the 10.
I was a bigger fan of it than some people have been. I've definitely heard some complaints about it, that it's a little difficult to sit through so much of it waiting for this big moment, which is the he's going to cut his arm off. But I actually found it to be a terrific movie, and I think that James Franco is very, very good in it, and I enjoyed that one too. Now, which one would you say is your least favorite?
Clear-cut least favorite, The Kids Are All Right.
Oh my God. Oh my God, this movie. The kids are all boring. I wanted every one of these characters to be smote by a meteor. Individually, repeatedly. I haven't worked out the physics exactly how that would happen. But
there
oh
are
my
movies
God.
In which people are smote by meteors, too. It's not like it's outside
smitten
the realm
people.
Of...
Smitten.
Smitten? Smote? Okay.
You know what that movie needed? That movie needed Mike Katziff.
More Katziff.
More Mike Katziff. Mike Katziff, our esteemed producer, routinely, every single week, takes an hour and 10 minutes, hour and 20 minutes, and whittles it down with a chisel, and sometimes with a brush, and sometimes with a big chisel and a big mallet. He would have whittled...
Michelangelo-like, you might say.
Yes. Would have whittled out the 20 minutes of flab in that movie that just has no reason to be there at all. That is a classic example of to, again, bring out the Linda Holmes joke about buffering appearing on the screen. There are scenes where there's just no reason. The movie is just sitting still.
It's entirely possible if I had stumbled across this film, if I, you know, I discovered this film, I might have liked it better, but oh my
God. Like on Lifetime?
Or...
Wow. Now, I'm not, okay. Wow. That's ridiculous. It is well acted, not well made.
It has a certain affection for its characters, and it's also making fun of its characters, and it does both those things well. It's just that doing them both softened the humor into really broad, sort of wet noodle comedy, really sort of tame jokes, and I couldn't stand it.
I don't know. I think this is a movie that invites you to dislike both of the female leads and then wins you back. I sort of respect it for that.
Especially on a second viewing, because I have now seen it twice, I also found that it did drag quite a bit and that it felt really long, even though it's only about an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah, maybe it felt longer because I kept going...
And I think my other issue with it, which I brought up with Stephen, without spoiling specifics of the plot, I will say there is an aspect to the way they resolve a variety of conflicts in this movie that to me is too easy in that it winds up blaming everything on essentially one character. And that character is sort of cast out. And then everybody else is given the opportunity to be redeemed. And that person is, I think, ill-served by the plot.
I will say I don't think it was a cheap redemption for the characters who have failed or strayed.
There are marvelous scenes leading up to that redemption. I didn't hate this movie. I'm just sure there was a movie that should have been nominated instead. I just haven't seen it.
After having seen Blue Valentine, it's difficult for me to justify nominating this for Best Picture and not Blue Valentine, which I thought was so excellent.
Well, that's it. And this is totally not the movie's fault, but I really found this movie to be horribly overpraised.
I think it may have something to do with the plot of the movie, right? I mean, this is a movie in which two fairly gigantic Hollywood stars play a same-sex couple, and it's directed by a lesbian, and there's some politics involved in that. Well, it's not that it's a bad movie or a weak movie. It's just that these things come into play sometimes.
It struck me as very slight.
Slight is exactly how it felt to me, particularly having just seen relatively recently a bunch of the other Best Picture nominees. It feels very lightweight next to those films I found. I think Annette Bening's performance in this movie was on my list of 50 great things about 2010. I really think she's wonderful in this movie. I think some of the acting in this movie is very specific and skilled and thoughtful. You know, I would agree with those who have noted. I don't hate this movie. I like this movie, and I'm very, very enamored of the performances in it. But ultimately, to me, the story lets them down a little.
Okay, better or worse than Black Swan? Because I saw Black Swan, and to me, that is one very pretty bag of nonsense, as I may have said last week.
You know what? Black Swan has improved in my estimation since I saw it, in part because I saw a bunch of these other movies, and it was among the most visually inventive. There were elements of that movie and scenes in that movie I thought were incredibly silly. That movie has stuck with me, I think, in ways that others of these films, including the one that I think is going to win Best Picture, are not going to stick with me.
And which one is that? That
the King's Speech.
Yeah. I think all the signs are pointing in that direction right now, although we do still have a month or 3 weeks to go, right?
There is a certain horse race element where originally people were saying, oh, it's going to be The Social Network, and now they're saying, oh, it's going to be The King's Speech. I just think that the most redundant words I've seen on a movie screen this year were Harvey Weinstein and Max Weinstein. That is the most Weinsteinian chunk of Oscar bait I have ever seen in my life.
Speaking as an outsider, I haven't seen it yet, but that is certainly the impression I get, which is just this is sort of merchant ivory, masterpiece theatery.
I like Linda's theory about this movie.
What I have said to a couple of different people is this is essentially a sports movie. I saw one essay fly by online somewhere where somebody pointed out that it's basically The Karate Kid, which is the same thing that I thought when I saw it, is that it's a sports movie. And it's a sports movie that's fairly thick with sports movie cliches. And although I think, again, this is another one that I think is exquisitely well acted, I think it has a considerably better structured script than The Kids Are All Right. But in the end, I did return over and over to a feeling that I was watching them sometimes take a cliched approach to a moment where I wished that they had found another way to do it, where I thought, oh, I wish they didn't go with that shot. I wish they didn't shoot that way. I wish they didn't approach this in a way that makes it feel quite this much like it's a boxing movie.
And you're saying it's more like a conventional boxing movie than The Fighter?
Well, remember the property that sort of Tom Hooper got the most attention for right before this was The Damned United.
Right. Exactly. And I think that is an interesting thing to note. Again, I think we start all of these discussions from an understanding that these movies are, on the whole, very
good. These are good movies.
These are good.
There's nothing
movies
we're talking about that's not worth seeing.
The King's Speech is not a bad movie. I don't want to be in any way interpreted to be saying that. I
highly recommend it. I will not be crushed when and if it wins.
Of course.
I just won't remember it in 5 years
the
way a couple of these others I probably would.
I just think there's part of me that always really leans toward the idea of rewarding something that feels different to me or feels like it isn't falling into some of those cliches. Glenn, I know, you saw Winter's Bone.
Yes.
And that's one that I like a lot. And one of the things I like about it is that every time, to me, it seems like it's going to tip over into becoming sort of caricature-y about the country folk.
Mm-hmm.
It has these performances at the center of it, primarily Jennifer Lawrence, who's nominated for an Academy Award herself, that she is so utterly authentic to me and so devoid of affectation that it brings me right back to the movie and I feel, you know, I don't know. What did you think of that one?
Well, my friend Daphne Helland called it poverty porn, and I totally disagree. I really dug it. It was flinty. If the dictionary definition of flinty, this movie.
What is the dictionary definition?
I think
definition
involving
of
flint, which I don't think this did.
She's raw bone. She's a bunch of Flannery O'Connor verbs and adverbs and adjectives. I really dug it. It felt perhaps the most novelistic of the films that I've seen. Mm-hmm. I could really feel that it had the structure and the pull of a novel that kept dragging you deeper and deeper into this story. It's been said a lot, but it's a noir film, and it's a really interesting take on noir.
And it's a quest film. It's one of these sort of the main character must visit the various...
Exactly.
Yeah, it's as much a quest film as Finding Nemo.
Yep.
Just with more...
You get the magic sword or the dead squirrel. Either way.
Yeah.
Actually, it's precisely this question of poverty porn and wallowing among the Pope people in the country that has kept me away from it.
I have had
several evenings where the other half and I have been out at the theater and we've been going, Winter's Bone or The Green Hornet.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gone with The Green Hornet because I just can't get over that hump.
This is one of the reasons why I love to see a movie like this get nominated for an Oscar, because I feel like it at least pushes a few people maybe over that hump where they think, well, you know, it's really tough. It's a hard movie to watch, but maybe I'm going to give it a go and see how it is. I do think it pays you off.
And I will actually see this. You may recall that my New Year's resolution was to see all of the Oscar-nominated movies before the darn ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And I will manage it.
Yeah, for me, this is a movie that I would never have seen, but for people like me who are on a weekly pop culture podcast on which they promise to see all 10 movies that are nominated for Best Picture, this is one of the advantages of increasing the number of Best Picture nominees from 5 to 10. This would not have been nominated for Best Picture.
No. Mm-hmm.
And it's a really good movie. And one thing that really stood out for me about it is it was clearly made for about $105.
Yeah.
And is better paced than a lot of films that made a lot more money and sort of got a lot more, had a lot more money behind them.
And, you know, I think if anything upsets The King's Speech, it's likely to be The Social Network. What was your reaction to The Social Network, sir?
I agree completely with Linda, with your take on this movie, which is this is a really, really good film about a gigantic business venture and the effects that undergoing a gigantic business venture has on the friendships of the people who tried to start it. You said something about this movie that stood out, which was, it's not about as much as people say it's about.
Mm. Yeah.
This is not the story of a generation. It's the story of a business venture, well-plotted, well-paced, well-acted,
I think it's
well-executed, with some flaws.
Yeah.
There was all this foolish hype over, you know, the accuracy or the lack of accuracy about this movie. And ultimately, I just don't care.
Right.
And, you know, it's not like Zuckerberg needs to worry about this portrayal because dude is bulletproof.
They've also been pretty open about saying it wasn't meant to be a necessarily accurate portrayal. But if you try to make it into sort of, it's the movie of our generation that speaks to the times in which we live. Now you're talking about putting way too much on this movie. Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, the filmmakers in some cases, particularly Aaron Sorkin, who wrote the script, have played into that a little bit by sort of being like, I see this as this larger story about our society. I don't see it as that. I see it as a very good story about these two guys and how easy it is to have a personal relationship utterly fall apart when all of a sudden a lot of money comes along.
Well, for example, how are we going to deal with the fact that there are 2,400 fans of Pop Culture Happy Hour on Facebook?
It's going to tear us apart.
You are the worst.
And I agree with you that it's a fine, fine piece of storytelling. Just really well-paced, well-framed, handsome, good to look at, and reasonably perceptive about the way these relationships can thrive or fail.
Yeah. We also have Inception, which we covered on the podcast when closer to when it was released.
Right.
So you'll find
go back and dredge through the archives.
I've seen it again since. It's longer.
It got longer.
It got louder.
Boom. And rotatier.
So Inception, right. Toy Story 3, I think the general impression of Toy Story 3 I would agree with, which is it's very good and it's particularly very powerful near the end.
Sure.
I think Toy Story 3 got a little bit oversold. I've heard from a number of people who are like, this is just the clear-cut best film. The bar has been set so high and it just sailed over it. I didn't like it as much as Up. I didn't find it as powerful as some of the other Pixar movies, but the bar is set so high that a mid-tier Pixar movie, which is what I think this is still going to be one of the best films of the year.
I don't know. Is it more unified? Does it work better across the length of the film than Up did? Because, you know, we talked previously about how Up and WALL-E both sort of are a little weaker in the second half than they are in the first.
Up is way better.
I don't think Up is as weak in the later part as WALL-E, which I think is actually bad in the later part. I think Up is just average in the later part. Yep. And I would say Toy Story 3 sort of has a similar arc in the other direction. It's relatively ordinary going through, but then at the end, it's very, very strong. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of the Up structure.
It's the inversion of Up.
It's the inversion of Up.
Gotcha.
These are tricky calculations we're left with here. Uh-huh. We also have not talked about True Grit, the Coen brothers.
Yep.
True Grit, anyone?
Probably my favorite of the 10. Well, probably my favorite of the ones that I've seen so far.
Oh, really? How many is that?
That would be the 5.
Oh.
I've seen lots of documentaries and foreign films. How many of those have you seen, Stephen?
And we should mention, we're going to come back at some point prior to the Oscars and have a conversation about documentaries and foreign films, because I think we all have some interest in sort of taking a look at those, and we will do that.
Those of us who are fans of the Coen brothers, and I've been a fan since they were screwing around making really cheap films with Sam Raimi back in the day, a long time ago.
Is that the truth? Yeah. Or is that just something you
no,
tell
no,
people?
No. I was sold. I just love what I was seeing. Have always had to contend with the fact that we get a sop come Oscar time, we get the adapted screenplay. Mm-hmm. You get the screenplay. Mm-hmm.
Also known as the Coen brothers and Quentin Tarantino.
Exactly, right. And Charlie Kaufman, sure. But that changed with Fargo. And ever since, I can remember, I've never been so excited by an Oscar win as Fargo, because I thought, this is a weird little movie that I dig, but I can't imagine the Academy is going to dig it. So now that they're kind of going mainstream and that they're accepted by many. I mean, I think this film is really solid. It didn't blow me away, but, you know, LaBeouf, can't go wrong.
Well, you know, speaking of blowing you away, one of the things I thought was really interesting about this movie is that despite the fact that it's a Western, right, it's their first really genre. I say that only because someone told us this week they have a drinking game where they drink every time I say genre.
Yeah. That's not true. Blood Simple was a noir.
No, what I was saying is it's their first genre Western.
Okay.
Would you say that it is a winning genre Western?
Oh, my God.
At any rate, despite the fact that it's a Western, it is probably less bloody than many of their other films, even though it's a Western. So everybody's got a gun all the time, and theoretically this is, you know, tough men of the wild, wild west. Less blood, less violence.
I will say, not all bodies remain completely intact.
That's true.
there are a few.
There's definitely some blood.
There's some lopping off in this movie.
There is lopping off in this movie as well.
Uh-huh. So it's a year
we
of lopping off.
You just can't get away from lopping off.
It's the secret theme of the Oscars.
It's the year of lopping.
Plucky teens and...
Lopping
things
off.
Getting lopped off.
loppings off. Even though it is violent, I actually found it to be more tipped toward the comedy part of their work. Not as much comedy as, like, let's say, Raising Arizona. It's not that far into their comedy side.
Or Burn After Reading.
Or the Big Lebowski, or the ones that have heavy, heavy doses of comedy. But it's definitely more comedic than No Country for Old Men. And it partly has preserved, I think, from the novel, some of that really nice language that's sort of entertaining. And there was somebody who left a comment for me, either it must have been on the blog, who said, I was really irritated by the fact that I went to True Grit and the people who were there seemed to think it was a comedy. They kept laughing. And I sort of thought, boy, I think that's on purpose. I mean, I understand the reaction because the themes are heavy.
There are laughs in that movie.
But
there are,
much of the dialogue is certainly meant to be laughed at, I think.
Yes. And that's their thing. I mean, Miller's Crossing has a certain lingo all its own. Mm-hmm. And Raising Arizona, of course, that's why it's probably the most quotable movie of all time. It just pays so much attention to language. That's something they've done. Didn't do it in Burn After Reading so much. It kind of goes up and down.
Yeah. It's also, you mentioned Fargo. I think the Midwestern speak in Fargo is not just the Minnesota, Wisconsin accents that are involved. It's also the way that people talk. And I think that to me, and I lived in Minnesota at the time, when I saw Fargo, it's one of those things where you think it's exaggerated, but it's not made up. The scene where the two girls, and I think they're from White Bear Lake, are telling the story about yes, and they wind up telling this whole story. And then there's the scene where the guy is standing in his driveway.
I love that.
And it is so, you would so exactly have that conversation with a real guy standing in his driveway, the way he explains everything. So I think their use of language in a movie like Fargo is similar to their use of language in a movie here, where the movie may be bloody in places, but it doesn't mean it's not also meant to be funny.
Yeah, this is not supposed to be an absolutely grim picture. Mm-hmm. And so I found it immediately very, very quickly paced, where, you know, I'd kind of glance at the ticker because it was the last movie I watched and it was really late. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, 45 minutes went by.
Yeah. Mm.
I always dwell on pacing.
We're talking about the humor that's sort of threaded through it. I do think of them as far too smart to be self-serious in a way that would preclude that kind of humor in an otherwise dramatic, bloody, grim story.
And one of the things that I think is so interesting about them is that Raising Arizona, to me, feels like a Coen Brothers movie if you've seen a lot of other Coen Brothers movies. But so does No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
And those are sort of, to me, the two extremes. But it's remarkable that films that are that different in tone and feel still have recognizable elements that somewhere the way the characters talk and relate to each other, you can still find your way into both of those films and recognize them as having some sort of relationship to each other.
Yep.
And I really liked True Grit, and I liked it more than I expected to, because I don't necessarily think of myself as a big Westerns person. But I really did like it, and I think the praise for Hailee Steinfeld in that lead role, for which she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress, is well deserved, and I think she's great in that
movie. And I would piggyback on all the people who are saying that she should play Katniss in The Hunger Games.
Yes.
Oh.
I agree. The other person from that movie that I would single out, and who I haven't heard quite as much about as some of the other people, is Matt Damon. Mm-hmm. And the reason is he has to do a very complicated, difficult thing in that movie, which is play a hint of attraction to a 14-year-old girl, but it can't seem predatory, and you can't really believe that he would ever pursue it or act on it, but you have to recognize that he has some vague hint of recognition that in a number of years, this will be the kind of woman that he might like. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's text. That's not subtext, right? I'm not making that up.
No.
They've actually talked, I think, fairly explicitly about not wanting to sexualize the character, but to understand her as a woman, right? There's a Fresh Air interview where I think they talk about that.
Well, particularly at 14 in that time, she was closer to being marriageable than she would be considered to be now.
Jeff Bridges, I mean, he did a great job. He's playing a cartoon. He's playing a larger-than-life sort of irascible drunk guy. Mm-hmm. Damon has to play a buffoon who you kind of like.
A buffoon with nobility, with a noble side.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
He's the white hat, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, he is, and he starts off as kind of the antagonist. to Bridges and to a lesser degree to Seinfeld, and then later has to really wind up being, you know, the guy where at the end of the movie, after she's dealt with her relationship with, you know, whatever happened to this guy and whatever happened to this guy, you need to hear that, like, you know, whether she ever heard from him again. And he becomes very much one of the people with whom she has a relationship. But I think what Damon has to do there is very, very hard. It's a very tricky acting challenge, because you can't, if you leer at her for 1 second, you're just going to turn everybody against that character.
Especially in a movie like this that is about story and character, that the first thing Matt Damon has to do is not be Matt Damon.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
I sort of wondered what you all thought about how well he achieved that.
I thought he did it very, very well. That was the next point that I was going to make, is that he has to not appear like a pretty boy who's dropped in with grubby old Jeff Bridges and just sticks out awkwardly, because he's done Western work before, but he can't look like Matt Damon.
Mm-hmm. Do you think of Matt Damon as a pretty boy?
I do.
Do you? That's interesting.
I certainly do.
Speaking for the gays, I do. Yes.
Do you really? It's not that I don't think he's attractive. I just don't. Pretty boy is not the kind of attractive that I think of him as being. I actually think of him. Maybe it's because.
But
maybe
in Talented Mr. Ripley and stuff like
Talented
that.
Talented Mr. Ripley is his movie where he's pretty. But I think that if you. Maybe it's because I got to know him as an actor in Good Will Hunting, but also in Saving Private Ryan, which I think he is really good in a really small part where he basically only has one big scene. Oh, when he was the super skinny drug-addicted soldier in the one with Meg Ryan.
Courage Under Fire.
Yeah. In which I think he was also very good.
Yep.
And in none of those movies did I think of him as pretty, I don't think. It's just it's a side point, but I was just curious about.
He is really a damn good actor.
No, he's very good.
I don't mean
to suggest that he's not. I just mean that he's got that. He's shot to stardom in such a big way with Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
And it's not pretty boy. It's not like New York, you know, Chelsea boy downtown pretty. It's an incredible wholesome attractiveness that I think has marked him out since the very beginning of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And it says movie star a little more than it does fantastic actor.
Yeah.
There's something I've noticed lately, and that's I'm getting tired of movie stars, but I love actors.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I first noticed it in the film Cold Mountain, a book I loved, where every time anybody turned a corner, it was, oh, there's Natalie Portman. It can't just be this woman in a cabin. It's Natalie Portman. And larger than life. And that's some of this distaste I was feeling, actually, I think, with The Kids Are All Right. It's just, I don't want these people to be stars that you can kind of recognize. I'd love it if I just saw people acting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, that's one thing about Winter's Bone. I mean,
it doesn't have
big stars in it, but you have great performance in which these people really inhabit their characters.
I do think that's why I responded to the film like that.
Well, have you seen The Fighter?
Haven't.
Okay. Well, Christian Bale has a very Christian Bale-y performance of Christian Baler-y.
Baleness.
Yeah.
A baleful performance.
Baleful. What did you think of The Fighter, Stephen?
I liked it fine. It is in many ways a very conventional, very loud actory sports movie.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to see a loud actory sports movie, this is a loud actory sports movie. I'm a little surprised, and I do not want to bag on Melissa Leo. I'm a little surprised to see Melissa Leo kind of run away with a bunch of the acting awards for what to me felt like kind of a shrill, caricature-ish performance.
I think that she's very good in it, and I think that Bale is very good in it. But I think those...
They're such
I do think they are examples of how a showy performance can be maybe praised a little bit beyond its actual level of difficulty. And I don't think being as big as they both are in that movie is as hard as maybe it's made out to be. And again, it's not that they're not good. We are talking here about a selection of good performances in good movies.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of picking out like why I didn't quite respond to it as much. And the comparison that I made, which did not necessarily make a lot of sense to anybody except me, but the comparison that I made to the Bale performance in The Fighter was actually Joaquin Phoenix in I'm Still Here, the non-documentary in which he plays himself as a drug-addled crazy person.
Yeah.
But the reason is they are both, to me, very skilled, very believable performances that completely caused me to lose interest in the person and caused me to think, I don't need to know what this person's story is. Hmm. Because to me, there are certain kinds of people where, yes, I understand what that kind of person is like. I understand perfectly through a strong performance who that person is, but I don't need to know what happens to him.
Could you two talk a little bit about conventional, because I'm so going to see this movie because it's David O. Russell. The last thing great, I would think filmmaker. Associated with him is conventional. And so I'm attracted to David O. Russell. I'm repelled by conventional underdog sports movie.
I think there is a grittiness and a realism to the setting, to a lot of the characters. It's a little, like I said, it's a little to the rafters. And believe me, I think Melissa Leo is a fantastic actor. And there are some terrific performances in this movie. I think a lot of the grittiness gets a little bit sold out at the end, where I think the movie gives in. I don't want to give away. I don't want to give anything away. But I think it gives in to a certain amount of rah-rah at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll be interested to see what you think of it when you've had a chance to see it. I'll be interested to see how you as a non-sports movie kind of guy. But that is all 10 Best Picture nominees.
We've done all 10. We've and done somehow all 10. I have seen twice as many of them as Glenn.
Yes. Shocking. Shocking. We will continue to chip away at the Oscars between now and then, mostly because it's fun to see movies.
Yeah. I kind of caught the... I'm going to go back to the movie theater.
That's so wonderful, Stephen. That's great. Kat's so sarcastically clapping for Stephen again. So that's the Oscars. As I said, we will come back to talk a little bit about foreign films and documentaries and also shorts, which will be playing in theaters before too long. And mm-hmm. Maybe we'll have a chat about those. So if you have comments about the 10 Best Picture nominees or other movies that you like this year, find us on Facebook, Pop Culture Happy Hour, or come to the blog, npr.org/monkeysee, and seek us out and let us know what you think there.
Yeah, what else should I see that should have been nominated instead of The Kids Are All Right?
There you go. Mm-hmm. And so we are going to move on from the Oscars to a segment that we have been neglecting for a while, I'm just going to say, and it was brought to our attention again on the Facebook page by our fantastic listeners, that it's been a while since we did a regrettable television pop quiz, so I have brought one for all of you to enjoy.
Hey, Linda, there's some sort of song that goes with the regrettable television pop quiz. Would you mind singing it for me?
Yes.
Maybe I'll assist.
The theme song goes, regrettable television pop quiz. And as Trey always notes, Steven's pop is a little bit late, but
a little behind the beat, but Mike can clean that up.
That's true. So we're just going to hit three quick clips here, and we'll see how you guys do at identifying them. Mike, can you give me the first one?
I didn't want to hear what anybody had to say. Like, I want to go. And all those people up there were, like, saying some nice, consoling things. Even though I just punched one of their roommates in the face, they were up there trying to help me out, and I didn't want to hear it.
Thoughts, anyone?
I'm going to guess Jersey Shore.
It is Jersey Shore. Yeah. Well done, Glenn Weldon. That's
the accent and the punching.
Yeah, it did have punching. That was the one sentence history is, you know, sometimes when your boyfriend has had a conversation with someone you don't like, you have no choice but to punch him in the face.
As you do.
There you
story
go.
Of my life.
So on to our next clip. My cats have hit it.
Let me ask you about... Dominique?
Dominica.
Whatever.
You don't put that kind of a girl into your house. I'm sorry.
She's great. She's very clean. She's a good cook. You like Dominica.
Mm-hmm.
He loves her. And she checked out.
You don't bring someone looking like that into the house. You either hire an ugly nanny or a gay guy. Ask any woman on Rodeo Drive. Ugly or gay? Or ugly gay?
Okay, I think I know it.
Yeah, I think we got this.
Downton Abbey.
Season 2, of course.
I knew you would get it, but yeah. Go ahead.
The Joan River Show, I don't know what it's called.
Joan
and Melissa?
It's Joan and Melissa. Yeah. It is Joan and Melissa. And this is the one where Joan and Melissa Rivers wind up living together, and Joan does not like the nanny because the nanny is too hot.
I see.
Are those two women... I feel like those women aren't particularly comfortable being on TV.
Yeah.
Yeah, it may be a new thing for them.
Camera shy. Yeah. Camera shy.
Yeah, I feel like they, you know, they...
I have gained a newfound love and respect for Joan Rivers, not Elizabeth. Joan Rivers, because of the documentary Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, which did not get nominated for an Oscar, but it really should have.
Boom.
It was great. I'm not tempted to watch this show.
No.
But respect. Yes. Due respect.
Yes. Oh, well, Joan. She's not to be underestimated. All right. Third clip. We're going to change it up a tiny bit. Mike Katza did it.
Time for your execution, Commissioner. Just so you know, I'll give you a decent head start before I pull the trigger. Don't want your brains all over my nice uniform.
Yeah, well, you're a disgrace to that uniform. You're nothing but a scum-sucking pig.
You know what? Killing you is gonna be a lot of fun.
But this is not Jersey Shore. We already did that.
No.
I just want you all to know that the result of that clip was that Mike called me over to his desk this afternoon, and I went over there and I said yes, and he said, "Killing you is going to be a lot of fun." So, anyone ideas?
Got nothing.
I have no idea.
How dare you introduce narrative fiction into the regrettable television?
You people do not know how to spot good daytime television.
Oh, that's daytime.
Oh. Days of Our Lives.
Wow.
And longtime Days of Our Lives viewers, or long ago Days of Our Lives viewers, will note the man being menaced in that clip, the man whose brains, the guy doesn't want to get Oliver's uniform.
Oliver's nice uniform.
Is Bo Brady, who has been on that show since before I started watching it in about 1984. They keep the people on these shows now until you would not believe. Anyway, so Bo Brady, still in trouble, Days of Our Lives.
Dude with a hair, long hair, long black hair?
Yes, yes. Well, Bo and Hope, wavy. They kind of both have long
hair. Has he been on that show longer than Eric Braden has been on The Young and the Restless?
I
have been mocking Eric Braden's voice on The Young and the Restless.
I would bet it's similar.
Oh, go ahead, Steven.
This farce of a marriage.
That's all I really ask.
Good. Solid.
That's a pretty good Braden. Mm-hmm. So that's the regrettable television pop quiz for this week. And you guys did pretty well. You're going to have to brush up on your soaps, though. Mm. And that brings us to the final part of our show. We are going to do a quick round of what is making you happy this week. Glenn Wilden, what's making you happy?
Two quick things, then a slightly longer thing. If you are not following Patton Oswalt on Twitter, you should be. And you should go back to the evening of January 28th, the Friday night, when he went to see the Jason Statham vehicle, The Mechanic, and live tweeted his gay crush on Jason Statham. Fantastic. What Twitter is for, people. Twitter is for jokes, and he knocked it out of the park. I'm also happy that I never have to see American Idol again because I discovered Paul F. Tompkins' recaps on Vulture. They are such a delight. But the main thing that makes me happy has to be the third season of RuPaul's Drag Race. Predictable,
yes.
Maybe. But can we all agree, can we stipulate in this room that reality television comes with certain over-the-top, ridiculous, melodramatic tropes? Do we all agree there?
Yes, we can agree on this.
Can we also stipulate that the best reality shows suffer from ridiculous melodrama, and that the worst reality shows suffer from manufactured melodrama?
Yes. Right.
We all agree? Okay. Mm-hmm. Manufactured melodrama is not a looming issue when you have 15 drag queens fighting over a wig.
They own it.
And how?
At the center of the show is RuPaul, who owns the silliness.
I would just like to point out that Glenn is right now making the international symbol for breasts with his hands.
I'm self-honking. She is the very personification of melodrama. So when she delivers a line in this show, like, it is time to lip sync for your life, I'm not going to try to do it because seeing her do it is a major reason to tune into the show. When she delivers a line like that, she knows it's funny. The contestants know it's funny. Her fellow judges know it's funny. And she owns it in a way that big balls of bland, like your Julie Chen your Probst.
Big Balls of Bland was the name of a drag queen. So I was trying to parse the logic of the name.
Yes. If this show did not exist, the universe would have eventually created it because reality television and drag belong together in a way that I have not unpacked yet because I haven't written this particular graduate thesis. They are the very same thing.
There you go.
Absolutely.
Yes. Genius.
That's all I'm going to say. So RuPaul's Drag Race.
Thank you, Glenn Wilden. Amazing. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I will have you know that I was threatened yesterday. I was told that if I chose RuPaul's Drag Race as my thing that was making me happy, that Glenn Wilden would rip my wig off. Mm-hmm. So
nice.
What is making me happy this week is snail water.
Boy, I got no reaction to that.
Mike is the king of sarcastic clapping this week. I was going to go with, boy, they do serve interesting things in the South.
No, snail water. There is at a research library here in D.C. an exhibit about the role of women in the medicine of the early modern era. It's kind of about rescuing the dignity of home remedy and the feminine experience from the idea that all of this was voodoo, all right? It's about examining both the recipe books and the literacy and scholarship to prove that what happened here was a kind of science, that these remedies, including, yes, snail water, which is made not just from snails but from earthworms and cooked for 3 or 4 days, that these things were tested and proved and passed down. There's a literature of it. It's at the Folger Shakespeare Library, which is where I saw a pretty delightful production of The Comedy of Errors this weekend, which is why I couldn't catch up with the Best Picture Oscars.
Whatever. I went to a concert, too.
It's not a contest.
Oh, I believe it is.
So much, I would disagree with that.
Because the role of the wife in The Comedy of Errors is kind of an issue that sort of underlies the comedy in the play, they have put this exhibition on about the tasks and the value of huswifery in this culture, right? So partly what's making me happy is the fact that they have an actual bottle of snail water, which someone has made following this umpty hundred-year-old recipe, right? The larger thing that is making me happy is the Folger Library itself. It is the world's largest collection of Shakespeareana, more first folios than the British Library, sitting right behind the Supreme Court, and this exhibition, like a lot of what it does, is free and open to the public. It's here through May, so if your kids are doing the spring trip to Washington on the school bus, come with them and check it out.
Very good. Thank you, Trey Graham. Stephen Thompson, making you happy this week.
First of all, the Green Bay Packers are in the Super Bowl.
This
weekend. Second of all, I'm closing in on yet another what I'm sure will be a successful chicken bowl, as we've discussed on this show. Third of all is my massive superiority over Glenn Weldon and Trey Graham. Yes. I feel like by having seen 10 movies to Trey's 6, I sort of automatically get to use phrases like, quote, the world's largest collection of Shakespeareana, and kind of waggle it in Trey's face, like, oh, you haven't seen the world's largest collection of Shakespeareana? And the fourth thing making me happy,
housewifery,
is Trey's use of the word housewifery. And the fifth is that I'm going to go back and download past seasons of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Oh my God, yes.
So absolutely, that is what is making me happy this week.
Terrific. Well, what is making me happy this week, I was really tempted to go with my new electric blanket. Because I will tell you right now.
Microwavable slippers.
If like me, you live in a basement apartment that is given to a certain Dickensian cinder block chill. You will understand the value of an electric blanket, even if the only thing you do is turn it on for a few minutes before you're going to be in there, just to remove the chill. But I felt like maybe that would not be of interest to everyone.
Maybe that would signify a life of quiet desperation.
It's possible. So I went with something else instead, which is continues to be slightly off the beaten track. I overheard on the Metro the other night the most delightful, skillful, witty, accidental live podcast that I have ever heard in my life, taking place among a group of teenagers who got on the train a few stops before. They were only on the train with me for a few stops, and they were, for some reason, they are clearly film buffs of some sort. And the topic during this particular perhaps 10 minutes that I was listening to them chat happened to be kids' movies, but I don't think that's because they only see kids' movies. They were clearly knowledgeable enough and articulate enough that my guess is they've seen a great number of movies. So I first overheard them debating between How to Train Your Dragon and Toy Story 3, but then they moved on to a greater explication of Disney movies and animated movies in general, which led to a truly wonderful exchange in which they were talking about Mulan. And a young man of Asian descent said, I hate that movie. I think that movie is so offensive. And another kid said, what do you think is offensive about it? Oh, the Mongolians. Yeah, the Mongolians. Well, just pretend they're Russians. And it really made me laugh. They were extremely smart. They were very witty. And I eavesdropped on their conversation for 10 minutes. They were a genuine delight. And I was within a hair's breadth of bravery from getting up and saying, here is a card. I want you to come in and sit with us because you're so funny and you clearly are so delightful. And it was a group of probably five or six of them all contributing sort of, you know, as these groups have one sort of, you know, guy who directs the discussion says, okay, next topic, has any Disney villain ever died other than by falling? Because they all fall off towers. And, you know, and it's if you think about it, you have to kill the villain, and stabbing is, you know, very graphic, and other things are very graphic. But if they just fall to their deaths, then they just disappear. So they got, next topic was, has any Disney villain? And if this had happened in any circumstance in which I thought it was even conceivably possible that they had sought me out to audition for me, I would have suspected that that was what it was. But because it could not possibly be that, it was simply a delightful thing that came into my life out of nowhere. And frankly, I wish I'd gotten their info or something like that.
If only to replace me.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So what's making you happy this week is kids these days.
Absolutely.
That's right. How
Absolutely.
About that?
It was a delightful, delightful treat, and I really enjoyed them and wanted to share some of their genius.
You are working that positivity this year. Linda.
I know, right? So
I can't believe that what is making you happy is riding on the metro.
With teenagers.
That's like right. What's making me happy is watching the Packers lose. That's like your least favorite thing ever.
It is. It's true. Crowds on the metro. Other people on the metro. Who knew? So that brings us to the end of another Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. That's Weldon. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, I should mention, provides our in-and-out music, which you're listening to right now. Trey Graham can be found on Twitter at Trey Graham, which Stephen likes to sing, do it quickly, as
Trey with an E, then Graham like the cracker.
And I think you've just upset one Caleb Keller.
I was just going to say, I just noticed that about an hour ago, someone said, you know what, drop it.
Oh, for mercy's sake. You can also...
That's my tweet name is Caleb Keller.
You can also find Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. And of course, as we have mentioned several times, find us on Facebook. We're having a great time with the folks who have shown up to talk to us over there, and we are at Facebook at Pop Culture Happy Hour. And thanks to all of you guys for being here as always.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
And we will see all of you next week.